Good evening. I have a new face tonight. Welcome. How did you hear about us? Your friend. Wonderful.
Good
friend. Let's do introductions around.
Samuel. Britt. Ellie.
Don.
Catherine.
Marie.
Ron.
Christy.
Jeffrey.
Ritu.
Angie. I think I've met you, haven't I?
Yeah.
Yes. Nice you could be here. And Marie is back. Yay. Catherine's back. And it's spring. I grew up with those. Always forsythia and quince. Marvelous. So this is the book we're studying. Maybe Samia has told you about this mysterious thing that we're mystifying ourselves with, I think. And we stopped on page 99. And I started talking about this and then realized it was 8 o'clock, so I didn't really get very far. About the three modes of reality. Doesn't say three kinds of reality. It isn't three different realities. It's three different ways that we think we know reality. Three different ways that we experience reality. One of the things to remember in this study is that this is all about our experience as a human body and mind. So it's not creating another world for us in order to enter it and find some new truth. It's about how we experience what we experience, how to understand and clarify our experience as a body-mind. So this is so dense that it's easy to get caught in the ideas and the words, and yet all the way through, the Buddha, in this dialogue, is always reminding Mahamati that it's just words. Please don't forget, it's just words. Please come back to your own experience and understand what we're saying in terms of how it is that we know ourself or think we know ourself or imagine ourself. Because all of those things are involved. So he proposes three different modes of understanding and experiencing the reality of appearances. Imagined reality arises from appearances. And the trick of this is that forms appear creating attachment. So we don't have to become attached to what we see, but invariably we do, and invariably it's in terms of what we call the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. Or greed... aversion and ignorance. That we ignore the truth of things and want more of what it is that we see, and then instantaneously that just pure, clear seeing morphs into wanting it or not wanting it. And if you follow your mind carefully, you'll find that's just about how we are most of the time. The best way to see it is to walk down a busy street with a lot of shops. And you can just look in the windows of the shops and think, I like that, I don't like that, I could use that, I don't need that, blah, 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 all the way through. Yes, no, I want it, I don't want it. That's one way of seeing things, and that's a very common way for all of us. And it's part of our animal nature. We had to be very careful in discriminating, we still do, about what we choose for ourselves and what we don't. What's safe and what isn't. What's poison and what's healthy. It's an important aspect, but it's not... It's not real. It's how we think about things. It's not things themselves. So you can see there's the thing and then there's the click in the mind. And so the mind is then projecting on the thing and creating a story about it. So that's one way. The second way somewhere in here, attachment to name is the words. Attachment to individual and shared characteristics of external and internal entities. So it's about another kind of imagined reality. It's both imagination. It's both letting something click in our brain and then tell us what we think it is. The perfected reality is the mode that's free from name and appearance or from projection. That sounds amazing. And yet, if we practice Zazen, that mode is common to Zazen. We call it shamatha or samadhi. It's the being with things without thinking. It's doing without thinking. It's enacting our life without being self-conscious. So, as Red Pine points out, these are not three different things. These are just three different ways, three modes of our mind as we try to cope with understanding what reality is. What is this that we sit among and that we say, well, this is, you know, this is me. This is my stuff. This is, and yet, if we begin to analyze what anything is, we can analyze it all the way down to muons, and even smaller than that. We're really constantly shifting and changing physically, just an enormous, on the smallest scale, with huge distances between each piece of stuff. Immense distances. And on a larger sense, we're just little gnats crawling around the face of the earth. And there are other ways of thinking about us, too. And all of those are projections. All of those are thoughts about what it is to be. The reality is whatever's happening. I remember back in the, was it 60s or 70s, they used to have art pieces that they called happenings. And it meant that you went out and did something. You were something. And that's the truth of it. What we are now, right now, here. We're not anywhere else. And we're not anybody else. We're just this one. I just got the New York Review of Books, the new one, this afternoon, and on the cover it announces that Oliver Sacks is giving an essay in there on memory is not, that you can't count on your memory, something like that. That they've now been able to measure how we remember things, and it's very clear that we don't accurately remember anything. We think we do, but we don't. And so the more we act on our memory, the more we're living in a false reality. And we can see it so clearly in human relationships. If you watch carefully and encounter somebody that you saw even a couple of days ago, you can see how they've changed. They're not quite the same person that you saw 2 days ago. And if it's longer than that, you can see that even more. We're constantly changing. And if we carry a fixed image in our mind about who we're seeing or who we're being, then our relationships are very stiff, very crunchy, because they're not based on reality. The only way they can be based on reality is if we don't let that thing click in us, and that we allow our minds to be open to what's there before us. Be open to what we are right now. What am I going to say? I don't know. We think we know, but actually, we don't know what we're going to say. It just comes out of us. Our life comes out of us. So, number 24 goes on to talk about the last, what Red Pine calls the last of the major teachings that we've been receiving in this 100 pages. And this is the teaching of no self. Furthermore, Mahamati, bodhisattvas should become adept at examining the two kinds of phenomena that have no self. And what are they? Neither beings nor dharmas have a self. So that's easy. That's real simple. What does it mean that beings have no self? All the stuff that makes up everything, and they're called skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas, meaning the eyes and the ears and the nose and the tongue and the body and the mind and the color and the form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, this whole stuff that makes up this. And the ideas that go along with it, and the things that are we experience, they're all not anything that belongs to a self. You cannot claim it to be a fixed self. It's not that there isn't anybody who gets up in the morning, because of course there is, and brushes her teeth and drives a car and all of those things. But if you begin to try to imagine what that self is, you're making up a story. You don't have to call it, you don't have to be a self in order to be a fully authentic and fulfilled being. You can be who you are without being who you are. And that's freedom. That gives you the freedom not to be stuck somewhere, especially in the really difficult places. As grasping and attachment of such senses as the eye to form give rise to consciousness, bodies, houses, and the world of objects that are perceptions of one's own mind are fabricated and manifested from one's own projections. They change and disappear every moment like a river or a seed or a candle or the wind or a cloud. Restless like a monkey, attracted to impurities like a fly, and insatiable like a wind-blown fire, they move like a water wheel through life after life, and bodily form after bodily form, impelled by habit energy without beginning, like figures produced by some sort of magic trick or spell or mechanical device. To be skilled in the knowledge of such appearances means to know that beings have no self. And what does it mean to know that dharmas have no self? It means to be aware that the self-existence of the skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas is imaginary. That the skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas are devoid of a self or anything that belongs to a self, that they are assemblages tied to desire and karma, and that they arise from the interplay of conditions, but are themselves passive. In other words, we're not doing us. We're not breathing us. Life is living us. And the assemblage, this conglomeration that we are, is constantly changing. That we're made of stuff that is, as we can see, because we know that we're not who we were the day we were born. We are not who we were when we were 15 years old. We are not who we are going to be when we're 95. So we like to think, and in some sense, of course, we carry through a whole life history being the same, but that same is a very tentative and temporary sameness. So Buddha is pointing out basically that if we get attached to that and get caught up in the clinging and the aversion, that we suffer. That we have a really, really hard time. So he says, bodhisattvas should become adept at seeing no self in anything at all. So bodhisattvas who become adept at seeing no self in anything at all, and no self in dharma, soon gain an insight into the freedom from projections that characterizes the initial bodhisattva stage. And that's, again, those stages, the bodhisattva stages that we don't have to go into. And then he goes into this extremely poetic. As they continue their steady advance, they go beyond the ninth stage to the Dharma cloud stage, where they create huge lotus flowers decorated with countless jewels and resembling jeweled thrones on which they sit and practice in this realm of illusory existence, and where they're joined by bodhisattvas of similar attainment in their retinues. And then Tathagatas come, and Chakravartins, and it's a pretty big deal. This is what no self in dharmas mean. Because they see no self in any Dharma, they acquire the incomparable Dharma body of a Tathagata. In other words, they become a Buddha. Overshoot it again this time. So then he asks about assertion and denial, so that the bodhisattvas can avoid asserting and denying things. They're two pernicious views. And they're in the way of getting enlightened. So how do we do that? And the Buddha replied, assertions and denials don't exist where there is only mind. As for the body, the world, and possessions, unable to see these are mind. And bereft of any wisdom, fools assert and deny. So then he explained what it means, assertion. Refers to becoming attached to a non-existent individual or some characteristic of the skandhas, and etc. And the attachment, result of the attachment, such assertions of a non-existent characteristic are the result of attachments to the habit and energy of different mistaken projections. So, you can assert a non-existent characteristic, a non-existent view, asserting the view of a person, a self, a being, a life, or assertion of a non-existent cause, or a non-existent existence. Such as space, cessation, or nirvana. These neither exist nor do not exist, is the basis. Any dharma that neither exists nor does not exist is like the perception of a rabbit horn, or a horse horn, or a strand of hair. It neither exists nor does not exist. This is what it means by the assertions of non-existent existence. Assertions and denials are the projections of fools, unskilled in examining what are nothing but perceptions of our own minds. This is not true of the wise. Therefore, you should practice avoiding the pernicious views of assertion and denial. So I don't think it's necessary to even try to remember all these different ways of asserting existence and non-existence, but to realize that whatever we assert is coming from our own background, our own conditioning, our own ideas about things, and none of it is true. It's all thinking. And it's all thinking based on the causes and conditions that put us together in the first place and that is keeping us together, that this life energy is keeping us together, and we are spinning all kinds of wonderful ideas and dreams and words. And as long as we know what we're doing, it's not a problem. But if we begin to think that we're that it's a fixed world and fixed notions, fixed ideas, that our thinking can get fixed, then we begin to suffer because we bump into the fact that it's not so. And often we become at odds with ourself. There's the self that experiences, just has the raw experience of something, and then the self that would rather not be having that experience. or the self that wants a whole lot more of that experience. And so it becomes a lot of tension, internal tension that arises from just a misunderstanding, developing preferences that keep us from actual experience of what's happening. So that's basically what this part is about. That it's not fixed, and that's what we think of as self, as something fixed. So there's a little time for discussion, questions. Jeffrey?
And so Buddha knowledge is when you're in that condition you just described,
mm-hmm.
and you recognize it,
mm-hmm.
and you step back and let all that energy, this life energy you're talking about that comes from habit, you just release it. Is that what you're
not
saying?
Not even.
You're not even
not even.
You're just recognizing it.
No, not even that. You just live without the extra.
Without
extra? Putting another head on your head, is what they say in Zen. So if you only have one head, you're not even stepping back. You're just being what you are, right where you are. So you don't have to step anywhere or think anything. The more we think about it, the more mixed up we get. So it means we just have to be our own simpleton self, not anything special. And that's always a disappointment. You know, we're always trying in some way to get something out of this. And there's nothing like that to get.
So I suppose what I'm considering here is where how the wisdom of acknowledging that time that you experience, that there's an inner experience where you're feeling, you were talking about that, you know, the raw experience mm-hmm. of something, as opposed to, all right. No, I'm more mature now. I shouldn't be experiencing that. That's
oh, yes.
what I'm trying to talk
yes,
about.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. that grading of the, no, this is going yeah. on, and
right.
there's no escape from that going on. And so the mm-hmm. you're saying is just be there with it.
Yes. If you try to compare it to something, if you have an idea about how it should be, it's just an idea. You don't know how it should be. It's just the way it is. And then from that you can act. From the raw experience, then you know how to act because you have the actual information that you need. Otherwise, we're going on false information.
I see. I see what you're saying.
Mm. Right?
Well, about this life energy that Jesse mentioned, maybe I might not have remembered it right. Something about getting rid of it. I don't think you can get, we know if we can even get rid of it when we supposedly die. But, I guess. We'll find out later. But it's interesting that after this whole section, he goes off into this big, I kind of scanned it, this big discourse about what the bodhisattvas do after they become Buddha and they have thousands of samadhis, 10,000 of samadhis, and they go to all these different Buddha realms and all over the place. And
Well, he lays the groundwork for that. He lays the groundwork for that, and then he gives you the practice to experience it.
But interesting about this life, and I don't necessarily see meditation practice as other practice, the practice as renouncing life, we just kind of accept that, and you know, something happened with me, a close friend passed away. I don't need to go into the details, but it got me to thinking about it a little bit. You know, I'm happy to be alive.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's a lesson in all of the suffering connected with death.
Yes.
That, you know, every moment we have is
precious.
And, you know, we should make the most of every day. Every minute.
Are you seeing this? Are you hearing this as saying that we're getting away from life? Because that isn't what it means at all.
No, I don't see that.
Yeah.
Well,
I know. Those thoughts are very, very important, of course, because we're all going to have that experience.
We have this moment.
Yes.
This privilege of
yes.
life. And it's not going to, we don't really, or at least I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
After my physical body.
Right.
You know,
yes.
I just think I've learned something from recent experience, you know,
right.
In regard to grief and all of that stuff. You know, it's really this life is really important. This moment, this life,
yes,
is really a gift. You know, and we
absolutely.
And you know, that can include becoming a Bodhisattva.
It's especially important. Yeah. I learned that when I had cancer for a second time. And Coben sent me up to Green Gulch to sew a robe. And I didn't have a clue what that meant. I had never really seen one except on him. And none of the rest of us ever had a robe. And so I just went up to Green Gulch and began to sew with Blanche. And I thought I was dying because I just had a tremendous amount of radiation and a huge surgery, and I didn't know. Coben's advice was just keep on sitting zazen until your death day. That's what he told me. So, okay. And so with Blanche. And the other person sewing with Blanche was a man dying of AIDS. A very sweet guy. He was a costume designer from the Castro, and he was sewing his robe with gold thread because he thought it was cool, and Blanche said it was okay, and anyway, he was dying. And so the two of us would go outside during the break and sit in the grass in the springtime with flowers all around. We just thought it was the most happy, most joyous, most precious time in the world. It just tasted so good to be alive because we knew we were dying. We'd forgotten. We're all dying. All the time we're dying. We never know, but we forget until our best friend dies or we get a doom dumped on you or something.
You take it for granted, you know, we take a lot of things for granted.
Yes, we do.
But somebody, we lose it.
Yes.
We lose somebody close to us. We realize, gosh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about your loss.
But,
I know.
Really, you know, living reborn.
Yes. Yes.
Every moment.
Yes. We were lucky. We got born. Now go for it. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Well, it hurts.
If it happens.
It happens. It does. And it wakes us up. One more time. Well, it's a little after 8, so we should stop.